From his home on a deserted marsh close to a deep-flowing channel that feeds into Long Island Sound, marine biologist and author Carl Safina witnesses the months and seasons that bring continuing cycles of migrations, mating, death, and rebirth. During one year, he also traveled to distant points, coral reefs, and Arctic ice floes to gain a perspective on why and how these natural cycles are being altered and interrupted. His latest book, The View from Lazy Point, simply and eloquently describes the power, vibrancy, and heartbreaking fragility of our world. It's published by Henry Holt, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Carl Safina back to our show. Hi.
Thanks a lot. Great to be here.
Is Lazy Point an actual place or a state of mind?
It's a little of both, but it is an actual place.
A wonderful name.
It is a wonderful name. I was told it was named after squatters who used to live there.
I understand that Walt Whitman also enjoyed the same spot. What, did he write about it?
Yes, he wrote that he used to love to go over to Montauk and to sail around Gardner's Island. And, you know, that really resonates with me because I still enjoy the exact same things.
And is this your year-round home?
It was my year-round home. I lived there for about 5 years full-time, and I still try to spend as much time there as I can.
Well, you teach at
Stony Brook University, right.
So that's not that far, is it?
Well,
to me, Long Island is all the same thing. But, I mean, is this where you might go to think about things that you'd want to teach?
It's where I go to sort of check the pulse of the whole planet, really, in a way, and to clear my mind and fill my heart, I guess you might say.
Well, the subtitle of the book is A Natural Year in the Unnatural World. So much of what you described is beautiful and mysterious, but what's unnatural about it?
Well, if you think of the word natural as implying the things that happen without human agency, then almost the whole world now is unnatural because humans are really the main driver of changes on the face of the planet.
And when did that change? Because for most of our history, nature had the upper hand, didn't it?
Nature very much had the upper hand until, you know, maybe I would say the Industrial Revolution really was a revolution that changed absolutely everything and accelerated tremendously in the 20th century.
We are in the Holocene era. What does Holocene mean?
The Holocene era, it means whole new time, but there are a lot of geologists that now think that we are in the Anthropocene, a really whole new time in which the world is dominated by human activity, as you know, implied by that name.
And that's why some people like Nobel laureate Paul Crutzen are suggesting that the Holocene epoch is finished?
Is finished, yes. That's exactly what he's suggesting, and there's a very good reason to see it that way.
Are humans changing the world at the same rates and scales that were previously confined to geological and cosmic forces like volcanoes and comet strikes?
Yes, because, you know, like volcanoes had the ability to change the atmosphere. Humans are changing the atmosphere. Comet strikes had the ability to create mass extinctions. Humans are creating a mass extinction right now that's going on at a pace that we haven't seen in hundreds of millions of years.
I was just reading a portrait of Daryl Issa, one of the people in Congress who have gained new prominence. He thinks that that climate change is just a big hoax. It's a conspiracy.
I really don't understand how anybody can truly believe that because, for one thing, even if we didn't have any data from scientists, you can travel around to the ends of the earth and you can see that the polar ice is melting in unprecedented ways. The coral reefs are dying of heat stress in unprecedented ways. And then you measure the temperature and you see that on average, and especially at the poles, it's changing faster than ever.
But it's hard to convince the man on the street. Every time we have a cold snap of the sort we've had and more snow than usual, somebody says, so much for global warming.
Right. But, I mean, the weather and the heat balance of the earth are two different things, and you really need a big picture view, which is exactly what science gives us and exactly what I've seen in the travels associated with writing this book.
Carl Safina is here. His latest book is called The View from Lazy Point, An Unnatural Year, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. It's published by Henry Holt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Lazy Point also does seem like an enchanted place. The sun manages to rise and set in the same place?
Well, not exactly the same place, but you can see the sun come out of the water and go down in the water, and that's a trick that's hard to pull off for most places, but it sticks out in a way that makes that possible.
You say that nature's currency is energy. What do you see in nature when you follow the money?
Well, you see that really history is not a matter of politics. History is a matter of who gets the energy and where they direct it.
And you say your year of observation convinced you of the interconnectedness of nature. Do you believe if everyone could experience a year observing nature that way that we would all come to the same conclusion?
Well, I mean, I didn't come to it in the course of 1 year, obviously. But, you know, the thing for me is that I'm mainly an ecologist and I'm mainly concerned with conserving nature. Like, I like sea turtles. I like the idea of conserving coral reefs. I like the idea of bringing back endangered falcons and things like that. But what I came to understand in the course of my travels is that the things that bring those back or the things that destabilize them, the root drivers, are the same things that determine whether people have dignity and a future or whether they don't.
Well, not everyone who's grown up near the sea has the same outlook you have. Well, let's talk a bit about horseshoe crabs. One night you went out looking for horseshoe crabs, and first of all, what were you looking for and how did you know where to look?
Well, on the full moon in May and June, the horseshoe crabs come up out of the deep to nest along certain shorelines, as they've been doing for a couple of hundred million years.
What do they look like? They look like regular crabs?
No, they don't. They kind of look like a horse's hoof with a spiky tail. They do have they have a hard shell over the whole thing. They look also a bit like a helmet, you might think. They have compound eyes. They're more closely related to spiders than they are to crabs. So they're kind of wonderfully weird, really ancient animals. And to watch them respond to the moon and the tides and to appear on cue at the shoreline is truly a magical experience.
And you had a confrontation on the beach that night with a local. What happened?
Well, in a sense, with two locals, because I called my partner, Patricia, to ask her to come and see the horseshoe crabs. I knew she would be enchanted. And we were, momentarily. And then a pair of headlights came bounding onto the beach, and a pickup truck driven by a fisherman appeared. And he began to take all of the egg-laying females he could lay his hand on and throw them into the truck. And as we started to hear that happening, Patricia decided that if he wanted to take the crabs, she wanted to save the crabs. So she started taking them and throwing them out into deep water. And she was up in water almost up to her neck at one point. And he came along and we had a very, shall we say, very interesting conversation about whether it's okay to take some or all of the crabs.
Didn't he show you a license?
Yeah, the thing is, what he was doing was absolutely legal, but his legal limit was 500 per night, and there were a few hundred along the shoreline, but maybe not even 500 there that night. And the next month, when they should have come back to do their second spawning, there were only half a dozen females that I counted along that stretch.
But how is he doing any different from what his father might have done or his grandfather?
Well, this is the reach of a distant market. That's often the problem with natural resources. His father and grandfather used some horseshoe crabs for bait, for whelks and for eels. But now they're worth money and you can ship them out of state. So there's never enough for what you might need. If you need a few for bait, you get a few and that's enough.
And then you also understood that he could barely make a living from all of this. He was destroying the horseshoe crab population and at the same time he was barely keeping himself alive.
He had a job with the town. You know, you can't really make a living doing this anymore.
Well, if you can't persuade somebody like that to change his ways, What hope is there for change?
I think that when things get bad enough, people see the need for change. And, you know, things in some ways there are two reasons I wrote the book. One is to show that the world is still really full of vitality, living wild vitality. That is the hope that I see.
But we've been hearing a lot about the debate between fishermen and local authorities who try to limit the amount of catch, saying, you know, if you keep on going the way you have, you're not going to have anything some years down the line. And the fishermen say, well, you know, we have to make a living.
Right. Fishermen have to make a living, but not all the fishermen can make a living the same, doing the same thing that caused a much larger population of marine creatures to go to such low levels. We have to re-rationalize the amount that we take. We can use the world. We can use the ocean. We just can't use it up.
You described two beachings of large mammals, a whale and a dolphin. Were those unusual occurrences?
Well, they're unusual. I mean, they weren't unprecedented.
The natural or unnatural?
The whale's death was clearly unnatural. It had been killed by a ship strike. The dolphin's death was natural because when the dolphin at one point opened its mouth, we could see that its teeth were worn down to the gums, and it was a very, very old dolphin that had lived a very long life.
So when dolphins live a long life and they think it's time to die, do they beach themselves?
That's unclear. There are a lot of unexplained beachings of dolphins and small whales around the world. I'm sure that many of them simply die in the ocean. Some do come ashore.
My guest is Carl Safina. His latest book, his follow-up to Song for the Blue Ocean, is The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. It's published by Henry Holt. We'll continue our conversation after this. We invite you to check out our show page, where you can take a peek inside our studios with photos of guests like Joan and Melissa Rivers and Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein, and find out what some of our guests are reading and watching in our guest pick section. It's all on our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with Carl Safina. His latest book, The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World, published by Henry Holt. You traveled to Belize and Bonaire looking for coral reefs.
Mm-hmm.
What's the relationship between what you were seeing in Long Island and Belize or Bonaire?
Well, you know, I on Long Island, I was seeing sort of the ancient rhythms of migrations, and to get a perspective on global change, I went to these places. So in Belize and Bonaire, I was looking at what's happening in coral reefs in the Caribbean. I also went to the West Pacific, to Palau, to look at coral reefs as well. And quite sadly, in the Caribbean, a lot of the reefs are degraded tremendously from new diseases and because overfishing has taken off the fish that eat the seaweed that would otherwise cover and kill the coral. And so that seaweed is covering and killing the coral, because it turns out that corals really need the fish on the reefs. Bonaire, a law was put into effect way back in the 1960s saying that people cannot fish with spear guns, and that has allowed many of these algae-eating fish to exist in a way that keeps the reef. It's the nicest reef in the Caribbean. And then in the West Pacific, in Palau, those reefs, because the tourism there is so valuable, those reefs are really full of fish. The fishing is well-regulated, and the corals are really thriving. They even came back after a heat spike killed vast parts of the reef.
Couldn't we just export certain fish like parrotfish to the areas that are in trouble? Because parrotfish eat a lot of seaweed. They're vegetarians, in effect.
Yeah, they are. Listen, how much money would it take for these poor countries to try to import fish to restock their reefs? You know, I mean, these things are conceptually probably doable, but not practical.
You grew up fishing, didn't you? Have you ever given up fishing?
I've given up certain kinds of fishing. You know, I don't fish for bluefin tuna or mako sharks anymore. Those were the biggest thrills, really, that I ever had fishing. But it's now sad. It's not fun anymore because there are so few of them. But I still enjoy fishing for some of the more common fish and some of the ones that have started to come back.
What about the people who see it as sport and engage in catch and release?
Well, I used to enjoy catch and release, but it was my partner, Patricia, who really likes fishing, but she doesn't like hurting fish that we don't intend to eat. So I started to come around to her way of looking at it. So now instead of catch and release, we practice what I call kill and go home.
But you're, as you say, you're only fishing for fish that are not endangered species.
And not only not endangered, but also in several cases, they're more abundant now than they were 10 years ago because of restrictions and good management that's allowed them to come back.
You also witnessed abundances of birds flying through Lazy Point at certain times of the year.
Yeah.
What are they looking for? And where are they headed?
Bird migrations and most migrations of animals are about two things. They're about breeding and feeding. And so, you know, as the world warms or cools, they have to go to where they can either breed or find food. And every week is different. When you start looking, it's not like they just come north in the spring and they go south in the fall. In the middle of the summer, there are birds that have finished breeding in the Arctic that are already southbound and passing us, while the local birds are still breeding, and some of the tropical fish haven't even reached us yet. They're still on their way northbound. So it's really fantastic.
Well, aren't there large numbers a sign of health?
The large numbers are a sign of health. Not all of them are present in large numbers. Many of them are greatly diminished from the incredible flocks of birds that people described 200 or 300 years ago. And a few of them are recovering, like some of the falcons and the ospreys and things like that are actually recovering because of the end of the DDT era.
So we killed off a whole bunch of birds in our attempts to eliminate other things. We were just talking about the Panama Canal.
Right.
And DDT played mm-hmm. a major role in killing off the mosquitoes that were spreading malaria and yellow fever mm-hmm. in Panama. That was a good thing. But that was also a bad side. We were killing off other things.
Well, I think, you know, like anything with poison, the thing is to direct it at what you want to hit and not just spew it around all over the place so that you're killing the world as well as the mosquitoes. You know, these insect-treated mosquito bed nets are extremely effective. Spraying the inside of a house is very effective, those kinds of things.
Were you looking for salmon when you went to Alaska?
I certainly saw many salmon when I went to Alaska, but what I was looking for was a place that was still working, and I found it in spades. I was really astonished by the situation in Southeast Alaska, not just because it is, quote, still wild, but because a lot of it is actually coming back from past overcutting of the timber and overfishing of the salmon. And there are people everywhere you look there. You see some boats, you see some people. But there are enough people, not too many people, so that the place can really continue to work for people and for wildlife.
Has it recovered totally from the Exxon Valdez disaster?
No, not totally, no. The Prince William Sound area still has quite a lot of oil not too far under the surface and around the rocks, and many of the water birds still have elevated levels of toxins that are making their livers work overtime, and they're actually still dying at unnatural rates 20 years after the fact.
What about salmon? Are they doing okay in the Alaska area?
Salmon are doing well.
Because they're being overfished elsewhere.
Not just overfished, but also the warming of the ocean and the overcutting of the slopes that sends the silt into the streams is affecting them in different ways. South of Alaska, they're not doing well. And when you get south of British Columbia, they're doing very poorly almost everywhere.
Well, you say that lumbering was a big issue. Now Alaska is a major tourist destination. Will that actually help Alaska?
I hope so. I hope that the idea that the place is worth more intact in the future than it is destroyed in our own generation will make a real difference, and that would be fantastic.
Because there are people who are concerned about the impact of tourism on other places like Antarctica.
Yeah, it depends what you do. The colder a place gets, the more fragile it is for certain kinds of things. If you stay in a boat, it's generally okay. If you have a lot of people trampling around on the shoreline, you can create some problems.
And in Alaska, you fished for salmon.
We caught a few, yes.
Was that exciting? What's it like to catch a wild salmon?
It was wonderful. Many of them, when they enter the streams, they're not feeding. They're intent on getting to the breeding ground. So you do a lot of casting to fish that you can see before you find one whose dim recollection makes it decide to snap at something. And I was amazed how resolutely they remain determined to get to the spawning ground. So that made a big impression on me.
Do your friends who are ecologists also, do they frown on the fact that you go fishing for wild salmon?
Or, no, I mean,
is this like shooting deer as long as you don't kill too many?
Well, with deer, there are too many in most places. It's a rebalancing thing with them. And with salmon, if you take a few, and certainly there's plenty of commercial fishing, if it's well managed and you take not too much, it can be okay, and it can allow the recovery of these things, as we've seen with Alaska salmon or striped bass here off this coast or some of the others.
Were you competing with bears for the salmon?
I wouldn't say competing at the rate that we were doing it, but the bears were certainly much in evidence and all around, and that was a thrill to see as well. And the interesting
not
thing
scary
is
that, at all?
Yeah, they were scary. They got the adrenaline going.
Have you seen Grizzly Man?
Yes, I have actually.
I never want to be near a bear again after that, not even in the zoo.
Well, you don't want to get too terribly close. But if they're eating salmon and they're dragging them into the forest, you know, it's the salmon actually grow the trees in those forests. That's one of the reasons that those trees are so enormous. And those forests put on more biomass, more weight than any forests in the world, because the salmon take the ocean, create a fish out of it, take that fish up against gravity, serve it to the bears. The bears drag it into the forest. It grows the trees. The trees keep the streams cool, and the cool streams grow salmon.
Well, this is the balance of nature that has kept this planet going for so long. You're suggesting that in some cases it's still working, but in many cases we have disrupted it.
Well, we're at
the point where it's a serious problem for the future.
We're at a tremendous transitional point. And one of the main conclusions of my travels and my observations of all these things is that nature and human dignity require each other. I'm mainly an ecologist. I mainly am concerned with things like preserving coral reefs or saving sea turtles. But what you find is that those same coral reefs provide food for hundreds of millions of people. They block the energy of storms that would inundate and kill many coastally living people. And that our population problem, which really underlies all of the stress, is best alleviated by educating girls. So these things that seem like issues of just nature or nature conservation are also very much issues of social justice, and it all works together really beautifully, and that is the direction of the future.
So it's not just a matter of saving the coral reefs because they're beautiful, but they actually are important to life on the shore.
It's a matter of saving the future of humanity, because these are the things that make people possible. This is the context in not only in which humans evolved, but with which humans still very much rely.
My guest is Carl Safina, Safina. His latest book, The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. One of the more incredible moments in your trip north was when you'd gone north beyond what you called the peopled planet, and you still saw birds that were familiar to you from Lazy Point.
Yes, well, that's just an extraordinary thing about these migrations, is that the same birds that pass us, going north to the Arctic in the spring and coming back in the midsummer, they cover an astonishing range of the planet, from the high Arctic all the way down to, in this hemisphere, all the way down to southern South America. They individually range the breadth of the Earth twice a year.
But in that area, the where beyond the people planet, that's where people still go whaling, isn't it?
People go whaling in a few places, not necessarily that high up, actually, but they do go whaling mainly in cold waters, yeah. And the whaling is increasing, which I would vastly prefer that it go away permanently.
You mentioned overpopulation is a problem. We've known this is a problem for a long time. How do we stop that from happening?
Well, as I mentioned, you know, the main thing that makes people simply not want to have an unlimited number of children is education. And so educating poor girls, which is very good for them because it raises their ability to raise money, and then their children tend to do better. They tend to be literate. That's a compassionate way of taming these problems, is to help everybody actually do better. Not better in numbers, but better in quality.
But when you talk about educating people, you're going up against any number of different religions that don't believe in birth control, that do believe in having as many children as you can.
Well, I'm when I say educating, I don't mean educating them about population. I mean teaching them to learn to read and write, run businesses, and those kinds of things. And I grew up nominally in a religion that didn't use birth control, and that seemed irrelevant to me.
But, of course, that's where you get more and more children being born. There's some cultures where there are a lot of children being born. There are others where there are, if anything, there's a concern that not enough children are being born.
Yes. I don't think that anybody needs to be concerned that there are not enough children, because everybody gets more than, you know, you split up the resources per capita. The fewer people, the more there is for everybody.
Do you think that economists are indifferent to the environment?
I think economists are clueless about the environment, actually, because these things that they call externalities, which is the aspect of the trade that's not included in the price, is still a cost. So the price, the cost, and the value are different things, and economists don't understand that at all. They're willing to dump the costs on everybody, and we pay for it in the form of taxes or health or war, and we say things like, oh, coal is very cheap. We can't have clean energy. It's too expensive because coal is so cheap. Coal is cheap because the price is cheap. The cost is monumental. Coal is changing the heat balance of the planet. It's causing the oceans to turn acidic. It's melting the ice and letting sea levels inundate coastlines. It's putting mercury in our seafood. It's not cheap. It's just the price is so cheap that it's a catastrophe.
Is the answer government regulation?
The answer would be a market that would recognize the actual costs and put them in the prices, or government regulations that do things like eliminate the subsidies to big oil and big coal and put everybody on a level playing field.
When people want to make fun of environmentalists, they call them tree huggers.
So what?
It doesn't bother you, but
You know, the thing that's
you see it as a broad rights movement.
Well, I mean, the thing is that nature and human dignity require each other. You can throw names around, you know, but that doesn't help anybody understand what's at stake. Where people are oppressed, where they live with dictatorships, they can't afford to conserve nature, and their lives actually deteriorate in many material ways. In democracies, we've had the ability to take care of our environment. Where people live with dignity, they can take care of nature, and in demolished landscapes, they can't live dignified lives.
Carl Safina's latest book is called The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. It is published by Henry Holt. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
On tomorrow's show, physicist Brian Green discusses the possibility of multiple universes, and then Victor Garber and conductor James Bagwell talk about a revival of Kurt Weill's Knickerbocker Holiday. Also, New York Times journalist David Itzkoff on how his father's drug addiction changed his life. And we'll also learn about how bail bonds work and some of the social justice problems that result from the current bail system. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Jessica Ramey, Dan Volpe, and contributing producer Fran Jacobs. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.